Good evening. My name is Paul Holden-Graber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library. I would like to warmly welcome everyone to an evening with Nandan Nilekani and Thomas Friedman, the fourth in our Spring 2009 Live from the New York Public Library season. A quick but timely word about supporting this extraordinary institution, the New York Public Library. I would like to ask everyone present to consider becoming a friend of the library. Starting for as little as $40 a year, you are in. A cheap date, if you ask me. Please become a friend of the New York Public Library. Your support will get you a $15 ticket each and every time for all live events instead of $25. That is a $10 off each and every time. There's a membership table there at the end of the room. Please visit it after the event and join tonight. It will help our cause tremendously. Of course, you can also do so online. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our supporter tonight, Sutherland, Aspel, and Brennan. Sutherland, Aspel, and Brennan are proud supporters of the New York Public Library, and they are a member of the Lawyers for the Library group. Sutherland is a law firm with global reach, founded in 1924. The firm handles legal matters throughout the United States and worldwide. So please, a warm round of applause for Sutherland for their generous support. Earlier I stated that you could help our cause by supporting us. And what is our cause, you might ask? I sometimes wonder myself. Well, quite simply and joyously, to bring to you live conversations, discussions, debates, to present you with the best thinking around town, what I like to refer to as cognitive theater. From now on, you will also have the pleasure of viewing the events on iTunes U, on our website, reading transcripts of the past evenings and the conversations that have already occurred, such as John Hope Franklin with President Clinton, Al Sharpton with Christopher Hitchens, Gunter Grass and the late Norman Mailer. Actually, this was the last appearance of Norman Mailer in public. Zadie Smith, Krista Tippett and Stuart Brown, Toni Morrison, Alfred Brendel, Jan Morris, Robert Badinter, Jhumpa Lahiri, Mira Nair, Werner Herzog, and Matthew Sen with Salman Rushdie, or our very recent tribute last week to John Updike. And the list goes on, so do check it out, and also do check out our blog. And what events are coming up, you might ask? Well, Andrei Kondrescu will interview Henry Alford and Mark Twain. This will actually be my first impersonification as Mark Twain. The evening is entitled How to Live Dada. Follows a two-part series this spring, co-presented with Book Forum, entitled Cultural Obituaries on the Deaths of Black Nationalist Culture and the Deaths of Boom Culture. A two-part evening will follow with Alex Ross, Barbara Eisenberg, and Frank Gehry, followed that same evening by Alex Ross interviewing the composer and conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen, and much more. So do join our email list and our blog. Simply go to www.nypl.org/blog. After the conversation, please join Nandan Nilekani and Thomas Friedman for a book signing. It is a great pleasure, of course, to welcome both of them tonight. Nandan Nilekani is a co-chairman of InfoCIS Technologies Limited, the recipient of several awards, including the Joseph Schumpeter Prize for Innovative Services in Economy, Economic Sciences, and Politics. Thomas Friedman, as you all know, is a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner. His foreign affairs column appear in the New York Times. He's also of The World is Flat, and most recently, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Please welcome to this stage Tom Friedman and Nandan Nilekani. Together, together they are here to discuss the future of India, the subject of Nilekani's first book entitled Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation. Thank you very much.
Paul, thank you. Thank you very much. Someone's left us some money, Nandan. That's nice.
Great, even before we start.
In these times, that can be useful. Well, it's a treat to be with you this evening. It's a great for me to be with my friend Nandan. We just did a similar event in Bangalore a month ago, and it's great to be in this spectacular room in this spectacular library. So thank you all very much for coming out. Some of you may wonder, you know, how we actually got to know each other. We met, about 10 years ago.
Yeah, when you came to India.
When I first came to India, I met Nandan. And in 2004, I was doing a documentary for the Discovery Channel. And at the time, we were trying to think of what to do our next documentary on. And during the campaign between John Kerry and President Bush, the issue of outsourcing suddenly exploded onto the world stage, and I was kind of tired of roaming around the Middle East, and I said, well, maybe we'll go to Bangalore, the capital of outsourcing, where Nandan's company, Infosys, is headquartered, and let's do a documentary about that. And spent 10 days with the Discovery Channel filming and going all around, and Nandan was out of the country, and my last interview was with him, and I was so excited because I knew he was going to explain it all, because I had spent 10 days hearing from people about how they were now getting their x-rays done in America and read in Bangalore, and how they were tracing their lost luggage on Delta Airlines in Bangalore. And I realized something big had happened in the world, but I couldn't put it together. And I went out to Infosys' campus in Electronic City in Bangalore, and the film crew was setting up in Nandan's office. We were sitting on the couch out in the hall. I had my laptop on my lap. As is my habit, I flipped it open. I said, Nandan, I've been seeing all this. You know, what have I been seeing? And at one point in the conversation, he said, you know, Tom, the global economic playing field is being leveled. The global economic playing field is being leveled, and you Americans are not ready. Oh, I wrote that down on my little laptop. Okay. The global economic playing field is being leveled, and you Americans are not ready. Well, after the interview, I got back in my Jeep and was heading back to my hotel, about an hour ride, bumping along the road, and all the time I kept rolling over what Nandan had said. The global economic playing field is being leveled. And then it occurred to me what he was really saying was that the global economic playing field is being flattened. And then what just popped into my head is that Nandan Nilekani, India's really premier engineer entrepreneur, was telling me that the world is flat. I wrote that down in my notebook. I went back to my hotel, ran up to my bedroom, called my wife and said, honey, I'm going to write a book called The World is Flat. She now says she thought that was a wonderful idea. It's not how I remember the conversation. But I'm forever grateful and have always acknowledged then and now the true inspiration that Nandan has been for me for that book and for many other things. Those of you who don't know Nandan, let me put it to you like this. Seattle has Bill. Silicon Valley has Steve. Omaha has Warren. And Bangalore has Nandan, okay? And he has written a truly imaginative, creative, and original book, Imagining India. And for those of you who haven't read about it yet, there's been some wonderful reviews everywhere from The Economist to The New York Times to Time Magazine. And he's going to be signing copies outside afterwards. Nandan, let me just jump in. Let's start with the news. Stock market was up almost 500 points today. So the economic crisis is over. I just thought I'd ask you what it looked like. You know, I think we talked when we were in Bangalore how odd it was that here India, you know, was going through this long struggle of denationalization of its industries and financial system. And we're now nationalizing, you know, our auto industry and banking system. And it's like, are we ships passing in the night somewhere? What does our crisis look like from India?
Yeah, it is a very eerie experience because when we grew up in India, we grew up in a situation where the state was overpowering and ruled all our lives, and we felt constricted in that situation. It's only in the 1991 when we had the economic reforms that we had space for business and entrepreneurs, which led to India's economic growth going growing much faster. And therefore, I think the notion that the U.S. in some sense is going the other way is a disconcerting experience because...
Talk about that a little bit. Disconcerting. Is it... It's unnerving watching this?
It's definitely disconcerting. Mm-hmm. maybe unnerving too, because I've been here for the last 3-4 days, and watching television here has been a very different experience in all the years that I've been coming here. And I think, you know, it goes back to the question of what is the exact balance between the markets and the state, between entrepreneurship and the state. And I think we in India had veered to one extreme, and that cost us 40 years of development. It made our country grow slower, and while the rest of the world was galloping ahead, we were falling behind. And then we, you know, saw the folly of too much of state intervention, and we tried to create this balance. So I think here, I think it went to the other side. It went to completely unregulated markets, and then we're trying to bring it back. But in either case, I think we must make sure that we get to the middle ground and not swing either way. And I think we in India are watching this with a lot of trepidation, because in the last 4 to 5 years, India had 8-9% growth. And that also made us sloppy in terms of not fixing our own problems. Mm-hmm. And now it's very clear that we have to go and fix our own problems, because we can't have the global bubble driving our growth. So I think it's a big lesson for us too.
I want to get to the book in a second, but I want to do just a bit of biography first. You mentioned 1991, which was India's 1989. That's when the Berlin Wall fell in India, you know, basically. Take us back to the founding of Infosys, you know, which for India was as important as the founding of Intel or Microsoft or Apple has been for America. How did you guys come together? How did you get this idea?
Yeah, I think it was a very different time. 1981, India was socialistic. It had all this state stuff and all that. And most businesses in India in those days were either large state-owned companies, you know, public-owned, the government-owned companies, or they were large families like the Tatas and the Birlas and so forth, or they were multinationals, the IBMs of the world. And the notion that a bunch of guys who had no money, who were not connected by... They were not related to each other, they were really professionally in the same business, but could come together and start a first-generation enterprise like what you have in the U.S. was a very, very unique concept, and a lot of people dissuaded us from even trying such a harebrained scheme. And when we began, it was a very difficult time. It would take us months to get a license to import even a disk drive for a computer. Wow. And when you had to travel abroad, you had to go to the Reserve Bank, which is like the Federal Reserve, and ask for dollars to go abroad. And I remember once I went abroad for some work, and I went back. I had to go back again within a few weeks. And the clerk asked me, why are you going so often, you know? What's happening here? So you were actually answerable to the bureaucracy for the most trivial things. It's only in 91 that we got this breath of fresh air.
What happened?
Well, I think it was a solution that came out of a crisis, because India had borrowed too much. Its foreign exchange reserves were down to 2 weeks. It had no money. It had to actually ship its gold to the Bank of England to get some exchange. And it was really, you know, in economically...
You had to sell your gold to the Bank of England or send it there as collateral.
Collateralize it, yeah. And they had to seek an IMF loan to tide it over. And that was the time when people felt that we should really, you know, break it open. And they scrapped licensing. They made it easier to do business abroad. They reduced taxes. They did a lot of things to revive the economy. And for the first time, recognized that entrepreneurship is something we should encourage. And that was really like a breath of fresh air for all of us.
And that then really launched Infosys to a new stage?
Yeah,
or when was the takeoff?
Because from 1981 to 1991, we grew from zero to something like $5 million. Hmm. And then we went from 91 to now from 5 million to close to 5 billion. So clearly you can see that the trajectory of our growth changed dramatically. But it was not just the economic reforms. I think technology and what you talk about in The World is Flat made it possible, because by 1987, we had Earth stations, so you could communicate with the world over the Earth stations. And then by the mid-90s, you had fiber optic cables. So all the technological innovation also made it much easier.
So then let's talk about the book. What made you want to write this now? I mean, you're a successful businessman. You're a legend in India. Authoring a book, that must have been a pretty daunting idea to you?
Oh, yeah, it was a crazy idea. But it's no crazier than starting a company. You know? So it's, well, I think there are a couple of things. In the last few years, one of the roles I've played is been a global ambassador for Infosys and then ultimately for India. I used to sort of be a spokesman for India at Davos or many places like that. And I used to meet many people who used to ask me to explain India's contradictions. You know, why is it that you seem to have this high-tech talent and these IITs, and why do you have this huge number of young people, children who don't have education? Why is it that you have such a beautiful campus in your office and you have the world's largest slums? Why is it that there's a part of India which seems to be still in the 17th century and there's a part which is doing space rockets and 21st century? Why is it that you have so many billionaires and so many poor people? And, you know, I couldn't really explain these contradictions. And finally, I said, I must once and for all figure out why it is the way it is. So in some sense, it was a journey of self-discovery for me to really figure out why India is the way it is. And the other thing was that I started sensing that India had a small window of opportunity where it was enjoying this demographic dividend. It was going to have a huge number of young people in the working age for the next 30, 40 years.
And that's what's a democratic dividend?
Demographic dividend. Yeah, it's a term actually coined by people here, David Bloom and Williamson, which is that in a country, there's a time when birth rates slow down. And therefore, the bulk of your population for those 30, 40 years is between the age of 15 to 65. Hmm. And you have less young people because less babies are being born, and you have less old people because that time there were less people. And when you have a large number of people in the working age, and when you have very few people to support, it's called as a low dependency ratio. Hmm. It happened in the U.S., for example, after World War II, when there was a baby boom.
And that fewer old people that need to, older people need to be supported.
Yeah. So, so more people to work. It's also the time when the society is most creative. Hmm. Because there are a lot of young people, they're innovative, they don't have too many worries. So, they can be innovative. So India is entering that era. Now, a demographic dividend is only as good as you harness it. To encash the demographic dividend, you must make sure your people have the right education, they are healthy, they have roads to go to work, they have jobs to get, they have lights to study at night. So unless you do those things, a demographic dividend can well become a demographic disaster. Hmm. Because when you have a large number of young people and you don't have enough opportunity and there are no jobs and they've been exposed to high aspirations through television, and they can't fulfill them, then they can be as much frustrated, disgruntled, and could get violent. And you see that problem in many parts of the world today. Right. So in some sense, we have to choose the high road or the low road. Do we take the road of the demographic dividend and encashing that, or do we take the road of a demographic disaster? And my feeling was India was at the cusp of these two choices, and I just want to make sure that that sense of urgency was captured. And that was the other reason I did this book.
I often felt, when I'm in India, that that energy you're talking about from that that demographic dividend. I'd like to always say to people, if you want to know what India feels like, buy a bottle of champagne, shake it for about 30 minutes, and then take off the cork. Okay,
yeah.
You wouldn't want to get in the way of that cork.
That's
you
right.
know, where though? It isn't just young people. I find when I go there, Nandan, it's. Young people with a basically optimistic outlook. And I'm not just talking about the lucky few at the IITs. You go into villages and small towns, you see farmers who want their kids to study English now for more years. You see in towns, parents who want their kids to go to a tech college or a computer school. It's really at all levels. Where does that optimism come from?
I think it comes from a realization, a collective realization, which I guess happens in societies, that if we do the right things, if we work hard enough, if we learn the right things, we can bequeath to our children a better life than what we have. And I think that's a huge, that's a huge source of energy because, for example, today, in India, in urban India, in poor urban India, in slums of India, 50% of the children go to private schools. Now, for these parents to send their children, these are not private schools, these are not,
right.
not Williams
exactly.
Academy or
right,
something.
Yeah.
These are small one-room tenements. And the poor spend a significant part of their income sending the children there because they believe that the government schools are not functioning. And they're willing to spend that income to get their kids a slightly better education so that they can do better in life. So the sense that, you know, if we can invest in our children, they'll have a better life. That collectively, I think, creates a huge momentum.
Last year, before the global slowdown really hit, how many young engineers, college graduates, applied for jobs at Infosys? How many were you able to take?
I would say we would get about 1.5 million applications.
1.5 million applications.
Yeah. And we would recruit about 25,000.
25,000.
Yeah. You know, in a city called Mysore, not far from Bangalore, we have what we believe is the world's largest corporate university, where we can train 13,500 people at a time. And it's a residential campus. They all stay there. We have all rooms and hostels. And if we take a typical training as 4 months, we can train 40,000 people a year. So we really built a huge, $500 million investment.
So you're running a university.
Oh, yeah. We're running the world's largest corporate university, I think. So that's the kind of thing, you know, and that goes back to the thing that I think India does not have, and you made this point, Tom, that it doesn't have natural resources. We do have some, but, you know, we can't live off, you know, oil or copper or whatever it is. And the only natural resource we have is our people. And therefore, I think the realization has set in that if we think of our people as our capital, and if we invest in them, then that pays us huge dividends in the future.
But that salmon that swims upstream, to be one of those 25,000 out of 1.5 million, what are you looking for? We got a lot of parents here whose kids are in college or high school. So what is a big, successful Indian multinational looking for from its new recruits?
Well, I think, you know, I think the nature of business, not just in Infosys, but in New York, I think it's becoming much more complicated. I think the pace of change has gone up. I think the ability to embrace change has to go up. I'll just give you an example in India. 40 years back, India was growing at 3.5% a year. That was called the Hindu rate of growth.
Right.
You know, it was destined that the country like India can only grow at 3.5. It's like it's in their destiny. And the population was growing at 2%.
Yes.
When the GDP is growing at 3.5% and the population growing at 2%, it takes 45 years to double per capita incomes.
Right.
When the economy is growing at 8%, and the population rate has now dropped to 1.5%. It doubles every 9 years. So suddenly you're fast-forwarded this thing. Something which took 45 years now takes 9 years. So and that is true in all societies. The pace of change has gone up. So I think our ability to be nimble and deal with change and adapt to change, I think, is going to be the defining thing, whether it's for Americans, for Indians, for anybody else.
Well, let me indulge myself just for one question. And it's one of the things that, whenever I see Anandan, I always say, what's the new thing? You know, where is the cutting edge of the story? And, Infosys's, you know, first job was doing Y2K remediation. I mean, fixing people's computers, you know, and then went to answering phones and then doing business process outsourcing in the back room. What's the new thing now? If I call up Infosys and I'm IBM or General Electric, and I say, Nandan, what are you selling these days? What would you tell people?
I think the requirements of businesses and technologies to transform themselves and to become smarter in the way they think has never been higher.
Why?
Well, one is on the business side, I think we are really being buffeted by extraordinary forces, right? You have the economic crisis here. You know, the markets are changing. Tomorrow's markets may not be in one part of the world, they'll be in another part of the world. The consumers are changing. The way you sell is changing. What you sell is changing. How you sell is changing. So, everything is being turned upside down. And that ability for companies to sort of transform themselves is becoming more and more critical. And therefore, we can provide that value to change. The second thing is the smartness of everything we do is changing. You know, in the old days, for example, If you wanted to ship something out, you knew that this box contained something, but you didn't know what was in the box. But as we become more and more granular in our measurements because of technological improvements, we can actually say what's not only in the box, what's in each carton, what's on each tube. And therefore, the level of granularity is going up. Or similarly, if you take the whole issue of smart grids, earlier days, we just piped some power into our house, but now we want to know how much power is being consumed by the washing machine, by the microwave, by the fridge. So everywhere, the information intensity is going up dramatically. And that's where I think we can play the role in the transformation as well as the improving the information intensity of businesses around the world.
So if someone here, though, Nanda, wanted to know, like, what exactly does Infosys do? For a company like a GE or for a big multinational, sure. What does it do?
No, I think, we work with large corporations, and they use technology heavily. US spends 8% of GDP on information and communication technologies. And we therefore help them in implementing those things in a smarter, better way so that they derive the benefits of increasing their revenues, increasing the profits, reducing the cycle time, collecting the money faster, very basic things that businesses do. We provide the technology support for doing that.
But you're also innovating with them as well now,
aren't
you?
Yeah, because what's happening is that, one, we have an intimate knowledge of how the business is doing and perhaps what could be improved. And because we are a global organization and we work with hundreds of companies, we are right there in the flow of ideas. So,
you're seeing the back rooms of all these companies.
Yeah, we're like on the highway. And everybody's stopping at our, McDonald's or whatever. Huh. So we can actually see this thing, and that gives us a unique perspective which we can sort of leverage to give new solutions.
Nanda, you mentioned the issue of climate, and when I was just in India, I was at a climate conference there, and one thing always strikes me when I speak to young Chinese and young Indians on the climate issue, is there basic sense of unfairness right now when we raise the climate issue to them? Their basic view is that, look, you guys in the West, you ate the hors d'oeuvre, you ate the entree, you ate the dessert, you invited us for tea and coffee, and then said, let's split the bill. And let's split the bill. And somehow they think that's not fair.
Absolutely. And, I think, yeah.
And so talk about both, how do you overcome, as someone I know who cares about this issue, on the one hand, that sense of, this is really unfair. But in the other sense, this is really a problem. And on the third sense, this is really an opportunity.
Sure. Well, I think the key is to separate out the global conversation from what we need to do for ourselves. Because the global conversation is very clear. In 1850, we had 280 parts per million of greenhouse gas equivalent in the atmosphere. Today, we are at 430 parts per million, 150 parts per million more. This is almost entirely due to developments in the rich countries. And if you go by the IPCC recommendations, we need to stabilize between 500 to 550. In other words, half the space in the atmosphere has already been consumed, and the developing countries had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So it's clearly there's a fairness issue of restitution for that. Similarly, on a per capita basis, the US is at 20 tons per head, the Europeans are at 12 to 14, the Chinese are at 4, the Indians are at 2, which again is unequal. So there's no doubt that from a global conversation point of view, there has to be an equitable deal which reflects the sunk costs of the stock as well as of the flow. Having said that, and that should be negotiated at Copenhagen or wherever, Kyoto, wherever it is. Having said that, I think it does not flow from that we should do nothing about it. I think that's an equally wrong attitude. I think we should say, and I talk about that in one of my chapters, that we actually have the luxury of seeing the rearview mirror and seeing the consequences of what has happened in the rich countries. And we don't need to go down that path. And therefore, because we don't have the legacy, because we don't have trillions of dollars in coal plants or whatever it is, we can actually reinvent our architecture of our energy consumption, go into a post-carbon economy, and convert the fact that we are behind into a strategic advantage by actually leapfrogging. Like what happened in our telephony. India has had 60 million lines of fixed lines for many years, and suddenly the mobiles came, and mobiles went from zero to 300 million.
And they have more phones than we have people.
Yeah. And today India ships 8 million mobile phones a month. So, you leapfrogged. You didn't have this huge legacy infrastructure of wireline, so you leapfrogged to wireless. Similarly, we don't have this huge infrastructure of carbon. We can leapfrog to post-carbon.
Nandan, I've been having this sense, and we just started talking about it in the green room before, that this economic crisis that we're in right now, this is more than just, you know, God willing, a deep recession. That something actually big happened in 2008, 2009. My friend Paul Gilding, Australian environmentalist, calls it the Great Disruption. And the way I like to put it is that it seems to me that both the market and Mother Nature hit a wall this year together. And I don't know if it was a head-on collision or they hit the wall separately, but something really big here happened. Sure. We had created a way of raising standards of living, which is so important for India, for China, for America, that we really couldn't pass on to our kids. The model was very simple. We built more and more stores to sell more and more stuff that would trigger more and more factories in China to make more and more stuff with more and more coal that would earn more and more dollars, that would buy more and more T-bills, that would be recycled back to America to build more and more stores to sell more and more stuff. And we were kind of in that loop. And I think that loop hit a wall climactically and financially in the same year. Financially, we couldn't recycle these imbalances without doing really crazy stuff. And at the same time, climactically, for all the reasons you've just said, it was spinning off, obviously, too many greenhouse gases. What was going on there?
I think the two crises, the global economic crisis that we're all going through and the ecological crisis, are actually both very, very similar. Because in both cases, if you look at the economic crisis, we had a model where the costs and risks of certain business activities were not internalized to the companies. They were externalized through different instruments. And therefore, you ended up with this model where we, you know, privatize the profits and socialize the losses. Exactly the same thing is happening in the environment. Because if
derivatives are the moral equivalent of CO2.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way.
It's a type of greenhouse gas.
That's right. We socialize the cost of them.
Yeah.
And
we hit this wall. Now, exactly the same thing is happening on the ecological side, because if companies don't capture the true ecological cost of what they do, if we don't put a price to those things, then their profits are artificial because they don't reflect the price on the environment, which is outside. And there again, if we don't do that well, we will externalize those losses, and that will lead to an ecological crisis. So you really have to think of the economic crisis as phase one. And you know, the next one is the ecological crisis. And it goes back to saying, unless we capture costs and risks of everything before we compute profits, we will always have these things.
What do you think could be the foundation? I don't really care about you. I'm working on my next book here. What could be the foundation of a new way of growing standards of living that wouldn't have these toxic financial and climactic byproducts?
Well,
how do we raise standards of living without making more and more Nike shoes?
Well, Philip Knight may not like that. He may want more shoes, but I think that parts. I think part of it is on the business side. I think if businesses capture the true costs and risks of that itself will do a
make that
a
will day. Drive it.
Yeah, because business is such a huge force,
yeah,
that if they don't capture that, then they can create this whole cycle which leads to all these issues. But on the other side, I think, you know, there's obviously we cannot deny people their aspirations. You know, I think, you know, I mean, let's take India. You know, you have a billion people. They're just discovering the way out of poverty. They want a better life. We can't say, no, guys, you can't have a better life because there's global warming. I think, you know, you will get booted out of office if you say that. So you have to come out with something which meets their aspirations, whether it's, you know, fixing up, creating the post-carbon economy, whether it's, you know, creating lifestyles which don't consume so much, whether it's about recycling, reducing, whatever. But I think we have to think that. In some sense, I think cheap hydrocarbons made us lazy. You know, if you go back and look at, say, a palace built in Rajasthan, which is a very hot and dry state, it's very cool. Not because they're using air conditioning. They have designed it in a way that it keeps its coolness. And so they had no choice. They couldn't use. But the moment you got air conditioning, then you didn't bother about design because you could just put in the air conditioner and use it. So I think we need to get back to that, the fundamentals of how we do things.
I was up at MIT a couple months ago, and I was talking to the interviewing the dean of engineering, and he told me, I don't know if this was the exact number, it was roughly this number, that in recent years, roughly a third of the engineering graduates at MIT were going to Wall Street. And you can, when I heard that, and it was before really the crisis hit, I think, but it really started to all become clear to me, because basically it was, we had taken all this IQ, really some of our best IQ from the Caltechs and from the MITs, and we put them into Wall Street. And these were guys and gals who should have been designing rockets, literally rocket scientists, then were designing financial instruments and regulating them. You know, we're basically staid bureaucrats from the, you know, 50s and 60s. It was a complete IQ mismatch. You know, you had these basically people educated in a very different discipline at a very different time trying to regulate rocket scientists inventing financial instruments. Do you have that problem in India?
Well, I think Indian regulators are very conservative, and they have generally been very careful about allowing new instruments and all these products. And in general, actually, I think India has the benefit, again, of hindsight in building a better regulatory environment. For example, take the banking system. We have a single national regulator for banks, the Reserve Bank. So, you know, it doesn't matter where the bank is. Or insurance. We have a single national regulator for insurance.
If you want to get a
The U.S. has 50 regulators each and every state because of historical reasons. So, in some sense, because we are starting on a green field, you could actually create a much cleaner regulatory environment.
I think someone told me if you want to get a mortgage in India, you need to put 40% of the price down, something like that?
Yeah, I think the bank generally, not one is the price down, and the second is that, you know, people have to be earning to you.
Interesting. Nandan, 40% down in this country, there'd be a lot of people not living in houses. Why should these people care about India? We have a lot of countries to care about. Right now, obviously, most of all our own, but we read about China, and we read about North Korea, read about Pakistan. Why is it important for us to, with you, imagine India? Why?
Well, I think it's very important, and I can understand that, you know, with what's happening here, you may say, you know, why worry about something down there? I think, first of all, you're talking about a sixth of humanity. You're talking about 1 billion people. What happens to those 1 billion people, whether they prosper, whether they don't prosper? I think these are very important issues for the world and for the future and safety of the world. So clearly, there's that part of it. The second thing is that I think, you know, there's this huge argument that especially a lot of Asian countries had the argument that economic growth and democracy don't go together. You know, when India was going at that Hindu rate of growth, 3.5%, they said, you know, the problem with you guys, you have all this democracy stuff. Look at us, you know, we had a few autocrats and we just made sure things happened. And the point is that unless a country reaches a certain level of economic success, it shouldn't have all these things called political freedoms. And I think India has shown that you can have those freedoms and you can grow. And therefore, if you really want to spread the notion that we want democracies, India becomes a good role model to show that you can have a democracy and have economic growth. So that's the second thing. Mm-hmm. The third thing is that I think it is huge in its diversity. You know, it has Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Jains, Jews, you name it. Every religion, it has the world's second largest Muslim population. And even though we have, you know, occasional disturbances, by and large, you have 1 billion people who speak hundreds of languages, have many religions, different ethnic groups, all living in reasonably peaceful conditions. And therefore, how is this diversity coexisting? That's an important lesson for the world, because we keep talking about this clash of civilizations. So India actually becomes a role model on how possibly the clash of civilizations can be addressed. And then, of course, I think, you know, India's economic growth will decide the population and you know, elimination of poverty on the world. And finally, I think the question of global warming will have to be settled in India and China. So I think whatever way you look at it, you know, what happens there is very, very important to all of us.
One last question before we're going to go to the audience and give people a chance to ask. What, you know, you were trained as an engineer. You've grown as a business leader and an innovator. What was it like being an author?
It's great fun. It was a very different experience. And obviously, I was taking a big risk because, you know, you can easily get...
Absolutely.
You learn about reviewers and all that. But I think it was a different experience writing a book. But I learned that if you can think through the book, if you can think... And I learned this from you too. I think I learned many things from you, including the fact that you thought I had something useful to say. And therefore, I thought if I have some, you know, at least then I can write a book since I seem to have something useful to say. But more importantly, getting the structure right. You know, you get the structure of the book right, get the chapters right, get the framework right, then it becomes far easier because then it goes down to just doing each chapter. So I think I learned a lot of that. So it was a very, very different experience. And frankly, it's doing a book tour is not as punishing as doing an investor tour because, you know, you do an investor tour, you do 14 meetings a day, and they all ask you the same questions. So book tour is much more fun.
So John Stewart isn't as frightening as Fidelity, basically.
And they're all different. You know, each media thing is different in the book tour.
Your wife, Rohini, is here. Did you test ideas out on her? Was she like my wife? She'd say, you know, start over?
Problem is that we have ideological differences.
Uh-huh. Really?
So we argue about these. So after some time, we don't discuss it because it adds to the argument.
Well, I'm sure there's people who are, both have differences and affirmations here. So let's, please, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks, both of you. Could you address the collar situation in India, pink collar, blue collar, white collar, and how about unions? Are there teachers' unions?
Yeah, well, India has a very unique job situation. We have a lot of blue collar workers in the industrial sector who are quite unionized. You have a lot of government employees, white collar, who are also fairly unionized. In the newer private industries like ours, there's not that much of unions because they have come up in the last 15, 20 years. But what is really the disturbing part in India is that 93% of the employment is in the unorganized sector. In other words, these people are not part of a formal job. They have no safety measures, they don't have unemployment insurance, they don't have all those things. So that's the part which really needs to be fixed. We have to figure out how to reduce the number of people in the unemployed sector, in this disorganized sector, unorganized sector, and bring them into the formal sector.
Yeah.
From all what I read, there's a tremendous amount of corruption in India. The New York Times just ran a story a few days ago that
would you mind going to the
mic?
From what I read, there's a tremendous amount of corruption in India. The New York Times ran a story a few days ago that 25% of the elected Congress or whatever are either convicted criminals or indicted murderers or whatever. And from what I read, this corruption is really killing any effort of progress or social effort. You think this can ever be corrected in India?
Yes, certainly. I think corruption in India is a big challenge, and it is pervasive and corrosive. But I think at the same time, there are huge attempts being made to bring transparency, whether it's in business, whether it's in government, and you see many examples of improvements. And I feel that it's something which will not get solved in a day or in a year. Because all progress takes a long time. I mean, even if you look at the Western democracies, it took them 200, 300 years from their starting point to where they reach. So here we have a much more complex situation because the number of people is much more. It's 1 billion people. The rate of growth is much faster. It's 8%, 7%. And it's in a full democracy. It's so much more difficult to manage. So I think there will be corruption, but there's a huge attempt to make the society more transparent. It'll take many years, but I'm positive about the outcomes.
Hi, my name is Arun Agyar, and I used to be in the TAS. Tom Friedman asked you a question about the new thing you've done recently, and I wanted to ask you a follow-up question on the crazy thing that you've done recently. And that question arises from a clue planted in a column of his a couple of months ago when he was in India and interviewed a couple of young women, one of them an ex-Fulbright scholar. And there was a quote which resonated very deeply. And I organized something called the Really, Really Free Market, where everything you bring is free and everything you take is free. And it was so hard to explain that concept to people that I kind of developed a flyer. And I took a quote from your column. The world needs crazy ideas to change things because the conventional way of thinking is not working anymore. Have you done anything crazy recently?
I think writing this book was the craziest thing I've done so far.
Thank you. Please.
Hi. There was an article recently where they spoke about how the GDP in India is rising, but they looked at the Human Development Index, and in fact, actually, India has fallen. And a Human Development Index looks at things like education and healthcare and environment and things like that. And so I guess my question is trickle-down really working? And, you know, are these economic benefits really trickling down to, you know, the 70% who live in the villages and things?
No, I think you're right. In fact, most of my book is actually about that, is how do we improve access of opportunity to every Indian so that they can participate in this whole thing. Otherwise, they're going to get left out, and inequality is going to go up even further. And there are many reasons for that. For example, the poor were denied English. They had to learn in the local language. And unfortunately, the incomes that people get when they learn English is substantially more than when they don't. So automatically, you're creating an English divide. And so on and so forth. So we have had policies which led to inequality. And when globalization happened, those of us who had the skills to operate in the global world did very well. But those who did not fell back even further. And therefore, the only way you can fix that is by making sure everybody has access to the same opportunity. In fact, the whole theme of my book is that.
Please. Good evening. My name is Randall Rommel. I'm an engineer myself and now working in a financial firm, still employed, luckily. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a question for you, Nandan. As Indians, I'm born and brought up in Bombay, basically. As Indians, you know, Indian parents always say, I want my son to be an engineer or a doctor. These are two cliches we have. But I think personally that henceforth, in the coming years, we will have to make a bigger push in the arts. So we have, like, you know, both sides of the brain developed, and we are more... out there willing to take new risks. So, first of all, do you agree with that? Because, you know, I know you're the technological firm and you're an engineer yourself, sure. So it's hard to hear that. And how would you, you know, put forth that to Indian parents and the Indian government in the education?
Well, I think, you know, it comes down to having more opportunities and choices, because when you have very few opportunities, for example, if you take the IITs, you know, you have 400,000 people who appear for the exam for 4,000 seats. It's 1 in 100. And therefore, parents become very risk-averse. They don't want their kids to try something crazy. Well, I think if there's enough opportunity, then definitely a lot of young people will do different things, creative things. So it's really going back to opening the spigot of opportunities.
Thank you. Please.
Since we're in this beautiful setting in the library, I wanted to ask you a question about education.
Yeah, Francis.
And the way that Infosys gets a million resumes a year, many would argue the history in India is this almost a 40-year history of building the university system and the IIT, so much so that many kids in India today consider MIT and Harvard sort of their second choice schools behind IIT. A few weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago, the President of the United States came out with and shared the statistics about education in the U.S. So about one-third of kids in the United States don't graduate high school, and of those that go to college, about 50% don't graduate college. So when you think about the U.S. and the issues that we have here, one, would you send your kids to school in the U.S.? Mm-hmm. And two is, you know, are our problems, you know, much longer term issues, you know, for us to kind of have a turnaround success story like India had in economically?
No, clearly, I think Tom has written about this, and, you know, I think there's no question that in this much more competitive global environment, I think really focusing on education and making sure more kids graduate from school and more kids go to college here is really of the absolute essence. In India, actually, the bulk of the growth happened in the last 10 years because the demand for people led to more colleges being started. Then the fact that we had high standards forced them to improve the standards. So we created a virtuous cycle. And I think we need to do something very similar here because it is going to be a globally competitive world. And while we can erect barriers and protectionism and all that, but fundamentally, it's human capital that's going to make the difference. And the more countries invest in their people, I think the better off they'll be.
You know, after I interviewed Nandan for the book, I came back to the States. I was working on it, and I got to interview Bill Gates. And one of the most, I thought, really insightful things he said was that, and he just said this off the cuff, he said, you know, 30 years ago, if you had a choice of being born a B student in Peoria or a genius in Beijing or Bangalore, you wanted to be born a B student in Peoria because your life chances were so much greater than a genius born in the middle of a crazy cultural revolution in China, been born 30 years ago, but or a stultified, you know, Nehruvian socialist economy in India. When the world is flat, you don't want to be a B student in Peoria. Not when every genius in Beijing and Bangalore can now compete, connect, and collaborate more easily, cheaply, and directly with your kids or mine than ever before.
In the U.S., if you look at a high school student today, they take their SATs, right? And that's a national standard, right? And when you look at countries like India or, you know, other places or even faraway countries, they're operating on an international standard, which we are not, and that's a big issue.
But just a full disclosure, I mean, you have great universities, and both my children study here in those universities.
Please.
To continue on the discussion on education, my name is Christian Yazdanpan. I'm a program officer at Mark Echo's Foundation. A branch of it is Sweat Equity Enterprises. We teach 21st century skills via design and technology. And one of the things that we do is we sit middle school and high school students down with companies like Best Buy, Nokia, Nissan, and they skip product research and market research and product development. What industries should be hiring middle school and high school students here in order to design the future?
Well, I mean,
and I can take you out to dinner or have a drink afterwards if either one of you would like to talk about it.
Maybe send me an email and let me think about this.
Please, thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. Since 2000, there's been more companies from India that have captured the Japan's Deming Prize. Can you comment on of quality? Can you comment on Dr. Deming's influence in India?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because there have been two big influences, and both are American, on Indian quality. One is the Deming Award, which is Dr. Edward Deming was an American who went to Japan. And that has been done by our manufacturing companies because they want to, you know, have a greater part of the world market. And one way they could do that was through better quality. And that's the reason why many of our manufacturing companies have gone in for the Deming Award. But equally true in the software area, there are more CMM level 5 companies in India than anywhere else. And again, CMM level 5 is from the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon. And we again chose to take that model and improve upon it, and now many companies have that. So in some sense, the interesting thing is both these ideas, whether Deming's ideas or the SEI CMM models, are American-fostered ideas but adopted by companies outside to create better quality.
I'd like to try something, if I could. Ask everybody who's standing there to come up, ask their question, and for you to remember 5 of the questions.
I'll help.
Very short questions, yeah. Therefore.
Hi, Nandan. In your book, Imagining India, you talk a lot about entrepreneurship in India and how the scope for young entrepreneurs in India, and how, along with the businesses growing, all sectors of the society should grow. So in particular, what do you think is the scope of growth for social entrepreneurship in India?
Sure. Good question. He wants me to take 5 questions.
Second question, please come up.
I wonder how fast the awareness in India is growing that the two severe problems, the caste system and the still very large inequality of women, and how much awareness there is that these two problems keep India back.
Sure.
From growing.
Sure. Yeah.
Please.
Is there a place where you can go, whether it be a website or an organization or something, to retrace some of your steps and go over and visit, physically look at it, watch people interact possibly with the people who are working for these companies, go in there and see the Microsoft sign, see the IBM sign, and experience it?
You mentioned India's diversity, and my family is from the north of India, but I visited the south for the first time in December, specifically Kerala, and I was struck by both the diversity and the harmony. I mean, you have a huge Christian population, you have Muslims, and of course you have Hindus, but you never really hear about communal violence in that part of the country. So I was wondering if you have thoughts on what they're doing right down there and how it could be translated to other parts of the country, because obviously there is horrific communal violence in some parts.
Okay, and two more. The line keeps growing, so two more questions.
Paul, now we're forgetting the questions.
I got it. I'm writing them down.
Hi, I'm Harsha. Your leadership emerged from IT sector, and IT was torchbearer of Indian economy in 90s. Do you see IT playing any role in politics? I mean, can it be a torchbearer of political change now? It was for the economic change. And one view we have in India about IT sector is they came to party with globalization. I mean, they are not going to struggle. Do you find any value in that kind of social struggle? And what value do you find in that?
And the last question.
Go ahead and start answering.
Okay. So now I think I got it. It's, is there anywhere you can take a tour in India to see social entrepreneurs talking about caste issues and diversity that will also address IT people in politics?
Sure. We can do that.
Well, I think, let me, first of all, I think there is a huge role for social entrepreneurship. I think India actually has over 1 million NGOs of different stripes and persuasions. My wife, Rohini, herself is involved with 2-3 of them, like Akshara and Argyam Foundation and so forth. So I think there's a huge role for social entrepreneurs which is coming through. I think on the caste system, it's definitely been a huge load on India. I think the caste system ended up becoming a very sophisticated form of social exclusion which held India back. But I believe that as India modernizes, as people get more educated, they come to cities, they get the same jobs, you know, you don't care about the caste of the person sitting next to you in the subway. So I think that you will see caste system dissolving, but it is certainly a big challenge for India.
What was the other one?
Is there anywhere you can go really to see the whole world? Yeah, I would simply
basically
say
it's Tom Friedman's road tour.
Yeah, it's I wish.
On the website.
It's there really isn't. But, you know, one thing that Nandan will tell you that Infosys has summer internships. And how many applications did you get for summer interns last year?
Over 1,000 for less than 100.
How many?
Over 1,000 applications.
1,000 applications.
Over 1,000 for
over 1,000.
Just for
yeah.
100.
But for anyone who does want to see,
but
this
there is a guy called Arun Pai in Bangalore who says, who takes you to the golf course and says, this is where Tom Friedman stood and watched the sign. So there's a guy who does this. Yeah. He does it as a business. Yeah. You can go to him.
You can go to him. Yeah. We'll find his website.
I think it's called BangaloreWalks.com.
I'll summarize the last two. What is the, you know, and I've always felt this, that when I look at India, India is a miracle. I mean, it's what you said, 1.05 billion people speaking, you know, over 100 languages, different ethnicities, different religions, praying to so many gods, but yet every, you know, 4 years or so, they come together for free and fair elections that, while occasionally violent in many different places, nevertheless produce governments that rule in a democratic and consensual way. What's the secret? Because that's so important. You know, just think about if the world if India, you know, had been like Iraq at its worst moment, you know, in 2004, 2005, what a different world we'd live in if one-sixth of humanity had not worked out this internal balance and social structure. What's the secret?
I think the secret is really actually very similar to the U.S. I think both countries were born out of idealism. You know, the U.S., you know, it is about liberty, right. Pursuit of happiness, you know, the whole right. founding right. fathers. And whenever we have a challenge in the U.S., we want to go back and relate to what the founding fathers wanted of us. So there's always that ideal that we want to reach out to. India has the same thing because India was set up by idealists who want to create a fair, just society which is open, which is democratic, which did not have any caste. And it's a difficult ideal to live up to, but it brings everybody back to this ideal. And I think part of that ideal was that it should be a very secular in its diversity. That they knew they had no choice. What happened, I think, was when the British ruled, they divided India, you know, and they chose to divide and rule. And therefore, the Indians said, we will not allow them to divide us. Or when we become free, we will not be divided. And therefore, the whole idealism was about making it all the pieces work together. So, a huge part of the independence movement.
Before you go out and we sign books, just a last quick question. It's one you were asked in Bangalore, and really were asked here as well, and by a young Indian also, Indian American. Why don't India's cream of the crop of its entrepreneurs go into politics?
Because politics, the barriers of entry are such that it's very difficult for outsiders. It's not like the U.S. where President Obama can come out of somewhere, nowhere, and become the president. India doesn't have that openness of political competition. It's because it's been captured by forces, as I said, the many criminals and many people like that. But I think it's changing. I'll give you two examples. Shashi Tharoor, who was the UN Under Secretary in New York, is now standing for election from Kerala. He's got a seat from the Congress Party in Thiruvananthapuram, you know, Trivandrum. Huh. So that's, to me, it's a great sign that because someone like him is standing for election. Similarly, Mallika Sarabhai, who's again a very famous artist whose father was a very famous scientist, she's standing for election in Ahmedabad. So I think we're seeing this now where people from, you know, people like us, you know, who have led a separate life from politics and done something useful are now getting into politics. So I think while these are just two strands, you know, maybe they don't make the summer, but certainly I think in the next 10 years you will see more of that. And I think that'll change Indian politics in a very big way.
Nanda, thank you very much. It's a treat to be with you today.
Thank you.